Welcome to Russian History Retold, episode 216, an interview with the author of Before Evil, Young Lenin, Hitler, Stalin, Mussolini, Mao, and Kim, Brandon Gaucher. Our guest today is Brandon Gaucher, who completed his doctorate in modern history at Fordham University in New York City in 2016. He's an adjunct professor of history for Fordham University, and the Director of Global Education at the Derryfield School. You can follow him on Twitter at BK_GAUTHIER, or follow him on his webpage at beforeevil.com. Brandon, welcome to the show.
Mark, thank you so much for having me on. I've spent a lot of time listening to all the great episodes that you've done, and it's a real pleasure to speak with you.
Well, thank you. So, Brandon, can you tell us what inspired you to write Before Evil?
So it's a hard question in the sense that it comes down to a question for our listeners, which is, should we humanize the inhumane? As a historian who is passionate about history, is a means of explaining things, that part of the historian's task is for him or her to approach something that has happened, whether it be extraordinary or whether it be disturbing, and try to engage it as something that is explicable. And that has led me to focus on the story of despots, the story of tyrannical dictators, people whose guilt is total and cannot be excused, but who were human beings. I became interested in the humanity of inhumanity. That started with my dissertation, which focused at Fordham on the history of U.S.-North Korean relations. And throughout the process of doing that dissertation, I was able to go to North Korea, and I saw the bodies of Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il. And that's a whole nother story for a whole nother time, Mark. But I'll say this. Seeing those bodies, I wrestled with the notion that these were actual people who did horrific things to their fellow man and woman. And I thought about the body of Lenin in Red Square. And for a time, Stalin's body was there as well. And it also leads back to begin with the North Korea intro before we get to the Russian rulers. Question here, Madeleine Albright, former U.S. Secretary of State who just passed away, went to meet Kim Jong-il at the end of the Clinton administration. And she was told before she was going to meet this dictator that this is a weird guy, you know, who knows what the situation will be like. He might make you uncomfortable. So you should kind of be up for anything. And after she went to Pyongyang, the capital of North Korea, and met Kim Jong-il, she spent extensive time with him. She left and she was interviewed on camera. And they said, so what did you think of this guy? And she said, I knew all the terrible things he had done. I knew this was a really bad guy, but he was charming. He was likable. He seemed smart and in command of the facts. And that things like that keep me up at night. This is a bad person, but he is a human being just the same. And so I became really interested, as I said before, the humanity of inhumanity. And how do such people come to be? History doesn't explain it A to Z. You know, there's no one moment in their childhoods. But I became really interested in looking at their formative years. How do they become who they become? And what are the influences? If we can't explain it totally, how can we better understand the explicability of why human beings commit crimes against humanity?
Fascinating. There are two parts of the book, obviously, that are related to Russian and more precisely Soviet history, the stories of the young Lenin and Stalin. So I'm going to begin with questions about Vladimir Lenin. Why does Lenin's youth remain important for understanding his time in power?
If we begin by thinking about the Russian Civil War, before we go into depth about his youth, this is a leader who commits heinous crimes during that conflict. The Romanovs are executed in a basement, brutally so. His regime, as it is beginning the Civil War, which was the notion of the Bolsheviks winning that conflict. When they seize power, they control two major cities. It's almost an impossible task. If we go back to April 1917, before they seize power, you know, within the Petrograd Soviet, there's a discussion by a Menshevik, you know, what party would actually want to seize power in Russia? And Lenin apocryphally, he doesn't say this exact word at the moment, but the apocryphal story is he stands up and says, there is such a party. What actually happened was the next time he was speaking at the rostrum, you know, he said at the podium, there is a party. The Bolsheviks would take this on immediately. And so when the Bolsheviks seize power, it's fair to think that they would all be dead or in exile within 6 months. It's hard to believe that they would actually win. The Bolsheviks are able to carry the day for a lot of reasons, but one of those reasons is they use terror against their enemies. They are ruthless as a means of ensuring that they will win the war. The kind of classic anecdote from Lenin is there's no revolution without firing squads. You know? So I became interested in his youth because the question is, how did Vladimir Lenin come to be? And as we engage his youth, I think a classic takeaway that we might expect listeners to have is I ask, what do you think was the most influential moment in Lenin's youth? And of course, listeners, his last name wasn't Lenin, it was Ulyanov, you know, Lenin is the name he takes on later. So what would you expect to see in his youth? And it's a frequent reaction to think, oh, well, surely there was great trauma. You know, so on what type of childhood produced someone who would order acts of murder? The reality is, though, there is a major moment of trauma in Lenin's youth as a teenager we can talk about. Vladimir Lenin had a wonderful childhood. He had great parents. He had a wonderful mother, a father utterly dedicated to his education. He grew up with Christmas trees, dyeing Easter eggs, sledding and ice skating, a world full of books and learning. His mom taught him the pun in German. I mean, they had a faux literary journal with his siblings called Saturday, in which they wrote faux articles, very important for a future intellectual whose life's work would be before the Bolshevik Revolution, writing and debating. So there's an inconsistency there at first glance. It doesn't make sense. So we have A, this happy childhood. Then we have C, a dictator who commits terrible acts of horror during the Russian Civil War for the sake of carrying the day for the Bolsheviks. And what was that about? To return to the dictator moment, the dictatorship, you know, for Lenin, acts of criminality, which we consider criminal that he commits, weren't viewed as acts of criminality from his mindset. This is for a greater end. This is to end rich and poor. This is to create a communist utopia in which there'll be no more suffering. And if that is our goal, how could you be opposed to using any means necessary for creating that end goal? Vladimir Lenin didn't view himself as evil. He would laugh at that. I mean, your bourgeois morality in which we're not going to do what it takes to achieve this larger end that will benefit all men and women. That is the road to tyranny. And we look at Lenin's youth. We see great education. We see loving parents. And the first major argument of before evil is that for dictators like Lenin and Stalin, but also Mao and Mussolini and Hitler and Kim Il-sung, it's not trauma that's decisive. It's a good education to fall in love with the world of ideas that empower young people. And in doing so, they, kind of second major point of the book, begin to view themselves in the form of the hero. What can I do to help bring about this reality? There's more to it than that, but at a basic level, that is in large part what it's about. And then there is a decisive moment for young Vladimir, straight A student, excellent across the board. And he ultimately has a great tragedy that occurs, the story of his older brother, Alexander.
And that's one of the questions I wanted to ask you is, how did the execution of Lenin's older brother, which we covered in one of our episodes, his brother Alexander, also known as Sasha, inform his worldview?
You know, historians oftentimes criticize or mock the notion of any one moment creating the before and after effect, you know, that like there's no one moment, for instance, in Stalin's youth that sends him down the road to mass murder. And I think that's appropriate to qualify any story of any one dictator along those lines. But the story of Lenin and Sasha, Alexander, that's a profound one. His older brother is a straight-A student, just like him. A great kid. Alexander and Lenin growing up, they didn't get along particularly well, but they were competitive in a sense that Lenin from a young age wants to be like his big brother, like Sasha. It's a classic thing he says growing up, like Sasha. All right. So Sasha goes to St. Petersburg University. He's a straight A student. Lenin himself is in high school, straight A student. Dad dies while Sasha is away at school. And when their father dies, an important influence in their lives is lost. Their father did always encourage them to not get involved in politics. In the 6 months after their father dies, Sasha becomes involved in reading circles in which they begin to read illicit works. Now, you know, Mark, kids go off to college and become Marxists all the time. This is just something that happens, but they don't normally become terrorists. And the difference is that Sasha becomes involved with Marxist reading circles. He reads Chernyshevsky's What is to Be Done in particular, something I can talk about momentarily, and decides that he is going to try to assassinate Alexander III, whose father, Alexander II, as I'm sure listeners have heard in prior podcasts, listening with you, was assassinated. Sasha is arrested, and it's Lenin, back in their hometown, who gets the letter announcing his big brother's arrest and says, quietly, a teenager struggling to digest the immensity of this, with a great understatement, this may end badly for Sasha. Their mother rushes to St. Petersburg to save Sasha. His sister, by the way, Anna, was arrested as well, although she was not connected to the plot. And ultimately, they appeal to the Tsar. The Tsar, by the way, reads her appeal, begging for her son's life. He actually reads it. Sasha Alexander, when he's arrested, is utterly, no repentance, not sorry at all. He says when he's interrogated, I'm proud of what we tried to do. I'm not sorry. And goes on in court at great length as his mother's in the audience at part of the time to say essentially, I did what I believed had to be done, and it's my place now to try to describe my rationale for doing this. The Tsar, Alexander III, actually comments. They have this document, right, that says, like, his sincerity is almost touching. his commitment to this is almost touching, right? He is sentenced to hang. His mother begs him, Lenin's mother begs Sasha to ask for mercy. Maybe you'll be spared, right? Maybe you'll wither away in a prison cell and not be hanged. And Sasha, no, I won't. He does ultimately submit a petition in which he says, he doesn't say he's sorry, but he says, for the health of my mother, I ask that my sentence be changed because I don't want to die with the notion that I'm ruining my family. But Sasha, who the Tsar lets be seen by their mother, tells his mother, you're going to have to look to the other kids for comfort. I'm going to be hanged. This is going to happen. I cannot go back on what I said at court. So when he is indeed hanged in May of 1887, Alexander Ulanov, Lenin's older brother, Lenin is just a teenager finishing high school. He's acing trigonometry exams. He's doing translations of Thucydides without any problem whatsoever. And there's a moment that's described in which he is sitting at a park bench and it's all over town. Everyone knows what's happening. But one student who is not aware that his older brother has been arrested and hanged for this plot to kill the Tsar, which makes his family, nuclear overnight. No one wants anything to do with him. These are two. This is a family now that raised a terrorist son. Lenin is sitting on a bench and a student comes up to him and says, are you okay? Like, you know, what's going on? And Lenin just very quietly says, they hanged my brother. And it's a moment of great consequence, the beginning of a journey in which Lenin has to digest what happened. He was interested. He wanted to be a professor specializing in worms. How did a natural scientist become sucked into a violent conspiracy? And by the way, what they wanted to do in this March 1st, 1887 conspiracy was set off bombs in a public square with poison-laced shrapnel that would have killed a lot of innocent people. I mean, it would have been a terrorist act. And so the story of Vladimir Lenin is he starts to ask, how could this have happened? He interrogates one of his brother's friends who visits the family. What was he like in court? What was it like when you were living with him? And Lenin's first beginning point is he says, Sasha must have believed what he was doing was right. I know that's true. And Lenin had read Chernyshevsky before. I mean, he was a huge fan of Turgenev, you know. He just wanted to read books like Smoke, in which he'll quote Turgenev at length at times in later documents. He'll make fun of people drawing on Turgenev. So he reads Chernyshevsky, and he sees it from a new light. He reads what his brother had been reading, and he begins to believe not just that he needs to follow in his brother's footsteps, but in this larger story of socialism, that he could bring about that reality. And the question arises, could he succeed where his brother had failed?
That is fascinating. You know, I can understand his feeling at the time, because my brother, Alexander, my mom called him Sasha all the time, was 10 years older than I. And, you know, he was this boy of the year at the YMCA. You know, he was great, you know, graduated salutatorian from his school. And, you know, somebody I always looked up to. And I could just imagine his execution if something like that would have happened. Well, that might have changed my life. Thankfully, he's still with us, you know. And so, you know, it's very relatable to see how one event like that can change a person's life and make them reassess what they want to do with their future. But which brings me to the next question of, how does Lenin's youth relate to the crimes against humanity he'd commit during the Russian Civil War? Because that Russian Civil War, and I covered it, and I want to cover it again, because I think there's a lot going on in there that I haven't touched before, but it cost the lives of millions of people. And it was one of the most brutal civil wars that, you know, we talked about the American Civil War. It pales in comparison to the Russian Civil War and the crimes against humanity that were committed then.
Yeah. I think what is so difficult to understand is kind of what we were beginning this conversation. How do people do terrible, terrible things believing that they are right? And that is such a crucial piece of the puzzle with Lenin. The horrors that unfold in the Civil War don't unfold because Lenin wants to be a horrible person and commit mass murder. They unfold because he believes what he's doing is right. And that makes us return to Chernyshevsky's What Is to Be Done. The search for a utopian future, but also the need for the vanguard, for the professional revolutionary. Lenin will speak very, very little about his older brother for the rest of his life. He says very, very little about it. But one takeaway that we know from what Lenin did say is this question of, or this point that Sasha gave away his life too cheaply. Like, Sasha's only crime, from Lenin's point of view, was not being good enough to achieve this larger end. And so from Chernyshevsky's What Is to Be Done, and I can't say that enough, right? If you really want to understand Lenin's youth, yeah, you can read his book, What Is to Be Done, which, by the way, is a great point to note that one of Lenin's most important ideological diatribes is called What Is to Be Done, named after Chernyshevsky's What Is to Be Done. If there was ever an example of the influence that writer had on him, who, by the way, Chernyshevsky wrote that book in prison and is written in coded language. If the czar censors ever made a grave mistake, I would say it would be letting that book see the light of day. Okay, so looking at his youth, how does this relate to the crimes against humanity? He believes what he's doing is right. He thinks there needs to be this professional revolutionary that Chernyshevsky talks about in that book. But in the process, we can see this, before we go further back into his youth, intersect really in many ways with Lenin's Marxist view of the world. So if we think about dialectical materialism, Marx prophesized, actually didn't prophesize, he said it was a scientific fact, that there are stages of history, right? And that these stages of history are going to unfold, just like, and what drives those stages of history is materialism, class differences, class inequities, and that eventually from capitalism, you will get to socialism and communism. But Lenin, this professional revolutionary, what makes him distinct in the early 20th century is Lenin, the Bolsheviks, aptly named the majority when they were the minority, and they don't exist yet in 1900, right? But we could speed up history. We could be the vanguard. Why do we have to wait 30, 40, 100 years to go through this capitalistic phase of dialectical materialism. And Lenin, by the way, views himself as the biggest Marxist of all, which is kind of a contradiction, as he makes the case, right, that this hardcore party of revolutionaries could speed up history, that we could move more quickly into this notion of a communist revolution. And the Mensheviks view that as terribly problematic. But Lenin himself begins to view himself as that revolutionary in part. There's many reasons, but in the aftermath of his brother's death, as he reads over the next decade more and more Marx, but also Chernyshevsky, that he could help bring on that future. Now, this is an important point, right? We shouldn't put too much weight on any one book, but here's what Lenin will say about Chernyshevsky's What Is to Be Done. Chernyshevsky's novel fascinated and captivated my brother. It captivated me. It plowed me over. It is a work which gives one a charge for a whole life. And the takeaway from that type of book was that you needed the person to be the hardcore vanguard, the revolutionary, to help spur on history. And what takes shape for Lenin in the late 1880s and 1890s is he begins to view himself in this light. He only lasts one semester at Kazan, at the university in Kazan where he goes, his father's alma mater. Lenin goes to college, you know, for a year. Oh, which, by the way, Mark, if we can remember, who's the person who wrote Vladimir Lenin's recommendation letter to get into the university, Imperial Kazan University? This was one of the great, if you had to make something up, like this would be a great thing to make up. It was old headmaster Kerensky, the father of Kerensky, the president of the provisional government in Russia after the Tsar's overthrow in the February March Revolution. So
ironic.
old headmaster Kerensky writes, because by the way, no university wanted to accept him. His older brother had been a terrorist. Right. His older brother had received the gold medal at their gymnasium, at their high school. And Lenin, by the way, finishes first in his class, gold medal. They declined to put his name on the plaque with other gold medal winners because his name would have gone next to Sasha's. So he gets into Imperial Kazan University. He lasts a semester. He very quickly becomes involved with a protest. And as he's being arrested in December of 1887, he says to a police officer who says, you know, what are you doing? You're throwing your life away. You know, this is stupid. Lenin says to him, the wall is rotten. One good shove and it will collapse. Thereafter, there could be no morality outside of realizing those ends for Lenin, realizing the socialist utopia. He'll say in exile at one point, quote, and what is a good person? Laughing. You know, I don't want to hear about the nonsense of the intelligentsia about moral consciousness, right? Morality is realizing that socialist utopia. And he actually, in Stalin, will embrace this next point of view, which is that the worse, the better. When there's a terrible famine in 1892 and his older sister Anna is trying to lead relief efforts, Lenin will say, what are you doing? The worse, the better. Let them die. It will help hasten the collapse of the Tsarist regime. What emerges out of his youth is a radical who feels utterly, utterly righteous in what he's doing. That is the road to mass murder. It's not necessarily that Lenin is this evil, demonic creature who wants to hurt other people. It's that he thinks he's right.
Wow. That's fascinating. And you look at some of the others in your book, and that's very similar. You know, they really do believe in what their goal is, and they will do everything and anything necessary. You know, which brings us to the next person. Some would view him as one of the greatest murderers of all time, Joseph Stalin. You know, Djugashvili, who would, you know, take Lenin and then kind of almost, you know, on steroids, you know, to take him to that.
That's such an important point, what you just said, right? I think typically over the 60s, 70s, 80s, there was the historiographical, meaning the history of the history, right? Some historians, you know, wanted to make the argument that Stalin is a deviation of Lenin, that the Bolsheviks go a very different direction from how Lenin might have gone. And evidence to support that is Lenin's new economic policy, a much more pragmatic approach to, like, at the end of the day, Lenin wanted the Bolshevik revolution to succeed. And there's this question, would Lenin have continued the new economic policy, the kind of quasi-capitalism of the 1920s for a time? And so that's an argument about Lenin that this might have gone a very different, a more humane direction than Stalin took the Bolshevik Revolution. Now, obviously, Stalin was much, 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 much worse than Vladimir Lenin. That being said, Lenin set the tone. That tone, meaning not necessarily we're going to kill a million people as we did, including a lot of Bolsheviks, 1937, 1938, but the ends justifies the means. And that we will be as ruthless as we need to be. No revolution without firing squads. So Stalin represents in many ways the much more aggressive expansion of Lenin's and justifies the means logic. And I think a problematic narrative about Stalin is that Stalin is only created by the abuse that he experiences in his youth. Yet at the same time, a narrative that has emerged much more in recent decades is that, we should not overemphasize the trauma in Stalin's youth because lots of people have abusive parents and don't end up being megalomaniacal mass murderers. There are many men and women who are totally moral, decent, good people who have troubled upbringings. And I think to be respectful to that, it's not only one's treatment as a child that determines who they're going to be. So there's this tension with Stalin's youth. His father, Beso, is, as you've spoken about in your episode on young Stalin, is someone who struggles with substance abuse. He's an alcoholic. He is very violent towards Stalin and his mother, which you also said, which is true. You included a great quote, right? In which Stalin will say to his mom later on, as the czar, so to speak, the Red Czar, why did you beat me so often? And she says, you turned out all right. And then, the question of, where are you now? Who are you? Mama, remember the czar? I'm like the czar. You would have been better to have become a priest. That classic exchange, he's really close to his mom. The story of Stalin's childhood, I'll talk about the trauma of his dad beating him momentarily. The story of Stalin's youth, the most important person in it is not his father, it's his mother, KK. KK in patriarchal Georgia bends over backwards, does every single thing she can to ensure that he receives a great education. Beso wanted him to be a cobbler, to make shoes, right? Note, crucial point, listeners. Cobblers did not lead the Bolshevik Revolution of October 1917. He was zealous ideological fanatics. How does Stalin become a zealous ideological fanatic rather than a cobbler? Because his mom does everything she can to get him into a good school and then ultimately gets him into the seminary in the capital of Georgia. Today's Tbilisi. So it's there that because of his mother's sacrifices, that Stalin falls in love with books. He's a bibliophile. Another problematic narrative about Stalin was the gray, dull mediocrity, which Trotsky loved to contribute to. Because if you want to be entertained, listeners, read about the exchanges between Stalin and Trotsky in the 1920s before Trotsky is exiled and leaves. It is the most acerbic biting back and forth. The level of hatred between them is immense. And the transcripts of their exchanges are pretty intense. So Trotsky contributes a lot to the notion that this was a mediocrity, dull, not particularly intelligent, not a very good speaker, which he wasn't a very good orator. But then the question remains, how did this dull mediocrity outwit some of the most brilliant minds of the Bolshevik Party to take power and outwit Zinoviev, Kamenev, Trotsky, Bukharin? If he was so unimpressive, and saying that does not in any way diminish the fact he was a mass murderer, but to say that he was intellectually incompetent, how did he carry the day in the Bolshevik Party? At the seminary, Stalin fell in love with ideas. He was an intense reader, loved to read Dostoevsky, Ernest Renan's Life of Jesus, a book that challenges Jesus's divinity, reads Chernyshevsky, reads so many other works that you've commented on in a prior episode. He falls in love with ideas. And like Lenin, the similarity is that he begins to believe he can play this larger role in furthering this greater good. Stalin's road to mass murder does not begin simply with a power-hungry sociopath. It begins with a bibliophile utterly determined
to be a revolutionary and see this larger socialist utopia realized. To become a Bolshevik revolutionary at the time that he did in the last 10 years of the 19th century is to ask to go to prison or be exiled within like 3 to 6 months. The longevity there is not good. It's not going to go well. Only the ideologically fanatical could engage in that task. So that is a crucial beginning point of understanding Stalin. This was a true believer. And will he be power hungry? Yes. Will he be a mass murderer? Yes. Will he show almost no empathy for those he murders? Yes. But you also have to begin with the power of ideas. And that's genuine.
And I just, I've just done a episode that I'm going to be publishing on the broader scale on my Patreon page on some of the writers of the Stalin era and how a couple of them joined the Civil War at the age of 13. And they were really learned children, you know, who had a great education, but they were so fanaticized into getting this utopia that they would join in. And a few of them got, you know, to go up pretty high in the Soviet hierarchy, you know, like Ostrovsky and a few others who really were, you know, fanatic. I mean, joining a civil war at the age of 13, I just can't imagine when I was that age that we would join something like this. But, you know, reading Chernyshevsky and some of the other writers and Lenin and, you know, the other ideologues at the time really got people to do things that they would never have thought of doing before. You know, and it comes to one thing about Stalin's revolutionary influence and his relationship with his first wife, Cato. How did her death shape his future? I talked a bit about it in my episode and how it really affected him and it kind of changed his personality. But what do you see from that, the death and the relationship?
I think it raises an uncomfortable question before we engage in his relationship with his first wife, which is, should we feel empathy for young 20-something Stalin, who is, and by the way, obviously didn't go by the name Stalin yet, but who is mourning the loss of his first wife, right? These horrible dictators who commit acts of criminality and mass murder later in life, can we look at them at an earlier moment in their life and feel any empathy for their suffering? And if we do, what is the purpose of it? Is that an injustice to their victims to talk about Stalin mourning the loss of his first wife and to feel any empathy for that loss? I make the argument in Before Evil that to examine such moments like Stalin's relationship with his first wife and the immense pain that caused him to feel for him as a human being, it's not the height of complicity. It is ultimately the antithesis of his tyranny. To feel empathy for him as a young person, that's what can make us different. Yeah. If we look at Stalin at the very end, soaked in urine, totally alone in a prison of his own making as he is an old man dying, if you can feel for him who least deserves it, that's the ultimate rejection of the evil Stalin propagated throughout his life. That's what makes us different. And I think that we should do that. Doing feeling for these dictators does nothing to diminish their crimes. Nothing to diminish the horror of what they caused. There is no reprieve for them. Their guilt is absolute. But we can humanize them, and we should. And there's a reason, bigger reason. That's not about them. It's about us. And I can talk to that in a little bit. But Stalin's first wife. Kato. She is met, right, at the height of Stalin's revolutionary career in 1906 in the capital of Georgia, in the Caucasus. And he falls in love with her. Note that Katerina is her real name, the same name as his mother. and what's really interesting is that for Stalin, as a young man, most revolutionaries, Bolshevik revolutionaries, didn't marry women like Kato. They wanted to marry normally other revolutionaries. There's a great quote that says, you know, so-so, the opening wording is mine, the great quote I'm taking from another historian. So was not looking for, quote, a stern, emancipated female revolutionary, a woman, quote, who chain smoked and practiced free love and understood that morality had no part to play in the brave world. Stalin chooses a religious woman like his own mother. And she is intelligent. She idolizes him and yet is not naive about the fact he's ultimately an ideological gangster. He's a dangerous person. Her brother is involved with the Bolsheviks. And she meets Stalin at a time in his life in which he is leading the mastermind of a local Bolshevik gang. But they fall in love. They actually meet at headquarters around the corner from the headquarters of the Russian government's caucus military headquarters. And they sleep together in a seamstress shop. And very quickly, she becomes pregnant by the summer of 1906. And they decide to get married. And what type of ceremony, listeners, do you think the ultimate Bolshevik gangster of the early 1900s has? A religious one in the middle of the night in Zion Cathedral. No one wanted to marry them, by the way, because he's a criminal. He'd already been arrested and sent into exile once. This is a wanted person. So they have this wedding ceremony in the middle of the night. At the end of the ceremony, they have a party in the early morning. His ultimate Bolshevik throat slitter, Kamo, his minion, you know, says at the party, quote, "Where are the stupid police now? We're all here. Come and arrest us." And Stalin, who is this ruthless gangster, you know, which I don't think is hyperbole. He is ultimately an ideological gangster. What do I mean by gangster? They will have you killed if you undermine the cause and get in the way. That is legitimate. Kamo ultimately leads this massive heist in the capital, but that's a discussion we can have in a little bit. So and Kato. Those who know them will say he was ruthless with everybody else, but he was so sweet to her that he loved her. "I was amazed," observed the husband of Kato's sister, "how Soso, who was so severe in his work and to his comrades, could be so tender, affectionate, and attentive to his wife. No one rivaled her except his mom, KK, who, by the way, had suspicions that their marriage was going to go terribly, terribly wrong. And she was right, because Soso's ultimate love affair was with Lenin and the Bolshevik Party. He ends up being a terrible husband. They have a son, Yakov, who Stalin will love, and they'll say his love for his wife and son became 10 times more. But ultimately, there is this heist in the capital in today's Tbilisi, and they have to flee. And Stalin drags Kato to Baku, carries on with the revolution like it's a mistress. And she is left alone in a shack by the Caspian Sea with this baby. And she becomes ill, and ultimately she grows ill to the point that she might potentially die. And so Stalin brings her back to her family ultimately, and you know, says, you know, by that October, you know, go to your family, get well. And he returns to Baku. And then ultimately he is contacted that fall, "Return home, you know, your wife is dying." And he blinks, he comes home, and he finds Kato dying. He hugs her withering body. He's there for her. He promises that he's going to give her a religious funeral, and he has to face the reality of his actions. This woman loved you, and now she's going to die. And you're largely responsible. And it's a horrible moment. She dies in his arms. And it's a moment where he realizes what his own actions had caused. November 22nd, 1907, she dies at her funeral. And by the way, there's a great photograph I include in the book that's from her funeral. He's standing with her family, who completely blames him for this. He's totally responsible. He's a terrible husband. He dragged his wife and child away to a city 12 hours away by train. She dies. There's a photo taken next to her coffin. And after this photo, Stalin fell to the ground bawling, sobbing. And at the funeral, he basically says, quote, or he says, as a childhood friend will write in a memoir, quote, "This creature," pointing at her coffin, "this creature softened my heart of stone. She died, and with her died my last warm feelings for human beings." He then points at his heart and says, it's all so desolate here inside, so inexpressibly desolate. Even Trotsky, who hates him so much, right, will say in his biography of Stalin, quote, this hard man's pale face reflected the heartfelt anguish caused by the death of his faithful life's companion. His emotional distress must have been very deep-seated and enduring, for he was incapable of hiding it any longer. Stalin will say later to a future female friend, quote, I realized how many things in my life I hadn't appreciated. When my wife was alive, there were many times I didn't return home at night. I told her when I left not to worry about me, but when I got home, she'd be sitting there. She'd wait up all night. It was self-pity mingled with accountability, a mea culpa of sorts, but no reprieve in the offing.
Wow, that obviously did shape his future. And, you know, but it wasn't, as you said, the one moment that changed him. There were many, many moments and issues that he went through. So, you know, it's sometimes it's excuses. You know, I've had a few pro-Stalinists contact me and tell me that I've been too hard on him and that he had so much trauma in life. And I've read a few biographies where they really point to that, whereas it should be just this whole layer that you bring out in your book, that it's a layer of many things that shape this future, a monster, gangster, you know, whatever, but, you know, and all the different people that you talk about. You know, I'm particularly familiar with a lot about Hitler. My family was in Germany at the time. You know, my dad was in the German army, but he was a one-eyed concert pianist. and his father was a staunch anti-Nazi, who only stayed out of the camps because he was friends with Wagner's widow, because he was a world-class violinist. And but you look at Hitler and you see all the different episodes in his life that drove him to it. And this book I really highly recommend to my listeners. And this has been a truly enlightening interview. And I hope that it inspires my listeners to go out and buy a copy of your book, Before Evil. And I want to remind them, they can get it at beforeevil.com when it gets released. And do you have a release date for the book?
Yeah, April 26. And if listeners go on to beforeevil.com, you can order a copy through the publisher. There's a link on the website, and they're signed copies. And I'll be writing personalized message in a lot of those first copies. So if it's before April 26, listeners will be able to purchase a signed copy. I believe they'll still be able to afterwards. You know, I just want to add on as well, you know, the guilt of these men is absolute. And someone might say in response, you know, why should we be talking about the loss of Stalin's first wife? Why shouldn't we be talking about the victims of the great purges? And I think about that a lot. And I think it's so important to not only honor the memory of the victims, the endless victims seemingly of what Stalin did while he was alive, but by examining his humanity, a core framing of all of this is this isn't only about Stalin as a human being. This is a story about ourselves. This is a story about what happens when we stop empathizing, when we stop viewing the world at a foundational level through the lens of compassion. To be compassionate doesn't mean that people aren't held accountable. It doesn't mean that people should not be punished. But what it does mean is that we can be different through examining human stories with the conviction that they are explicable. We can begin to understand why people became the way they became. There's no certain answers. There's no one moment in their youth that determines how they become a mass murderer. But here is a lesson. That lesson is that this is a story about us. And we, unfortunately, are susceptible to ideological radicalism. And what happens over and over and over in history is that evil, a lack of empathy for others, is something we become without seeing it. We become convinced that there's this larger end that we have to achieve, and we have to do whatever it takes to get there. And sure, this next thing we have to do is really disturbing. But if we don't commit ourselves to this goal and use any means necessary, is it a betrayal of this larger cause? And so the takeaway, empathy, mercy, love, we need courageous opposition to fight tyranny, but we also need to humanize everyone around us, because inhumanity is a human condition. Monsters aren't real. People are. And we should embrace empathy for all, even the monstrous, even as we hold them accountable.
And just, you know, that was the last line. This is a story about us in your introduction that I just found so powerful, because it is a story about humans, human beings. You know, humans were this species that are very similar, but our being is that uniqueness of each one of us as we go forward. And to say that this is a story about us, it's each individual has to begin to look internally at what they do and, you know, what their beliefs are. So, you know, this has been just fascinating, and I really enjoyed having you on here. And so, again, you know, this will be coming out shortly, this episode, and we'll, you know, I just again tell everybody I've read a lot of your book already, and it's just so fascinating, it's hard to put down. And so do go to beforeevil.com and enjoy the book. And I want to thank you for being on here, Brandon. And, you know, hopefully we can do this again sometime. And so, as always, das vidanya i spasibo bolshoya.
Thank you so much.